This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is your host, Sterling Allen. We have a guest, David Yurth, with us today. He is the Director of Science and Technology at the Nova Institute of Technology in Salt Lake City. The purpose of that institute is to champion the germination, incubation, and commercialization of sustainable leading-edge technologies. Thanks for joining us, David.
Oh, you're welcome, Sterling. It's my pleasure.
You have a technology that's got us quite interested, actually a number of them. In particular, you are working on a self-charging vehicle using basically ambient energy.
That's correct.
Where do we start? There's so many things we can talk about with you.
Well, we can talk about the self-recharging electric vehicle project if you'd like. We as good a place as any to begin.
Yeah, let's do. As we did a little write-up on this today, you have a number of systems involved in that. Freon rotary engine power, deep discharge lithium ion polymer, supercapacitors, thermoelectric generator, Peltier thermal electric, 12 different systems that are going to be working together. Maybe we could go into the heart of it. Isn't that the Freon rotary engine power generator by DMAT?
Well, let me start by backing up just a little, if you don't mind.
Sure.
The self-recharging electric vehicle concept has been evolving now at Nova for about 10 years. And the real holdup to its completion before now has been the fact that many of the enabling technologies needed to support its design really have only just begun to emerge in a sufficiently matured state so that we could use them effectively. The core concept is very simple. It simply says that we're going to try to build a vehicle that's capable of recharging its own electrical power system without burning any fossil fuels or being plugged into the grid, so that we're challenged then with a project that seeks to design, engineer, build, and field test a series of proof of concept vehicles that are capable of sustaining highway speeds without burning any fuels or emitting any exhaust, which self-recharge their own batteries and require no supplemental recharging from the grid. And that, in today's marketplace, even with today's increasingly efficient technologies, is a real challenge.
I just should comment, that endeavor is a truly remarkable one. Imagine being able to drive down the road without having to stop for fuel, and you're doing it cleanly. You're not polluting the environment. Basically, you buy the car, and it comes with its own energy generation capability inbuilt. You don't ever have to pay for anything after that other than maybe some maintenance.
Just maintenance and repair and service. There's a real paradigm issue involved here. And if you'll allow me, I'd like to kind of throw this on the table for consideration, because this really helps us determine how we're going to approach the problem-solving function. In our time, in the 21st century, automobiles are really viewed as foreign objects, which are designed to conquer certain aspects of the natural world. For example, body shapes are designed to be increasingly efficient at defeating aerodynamic drag. Engines serve the purpose of defeating inertia. Wider tires with increasingly pliant materials are designed to defeat friction and resistance and cohesion and so on. The fuel that we use to drive our devices is always outside the unit. That is, the fuel system and the vehicle itself are viewed as extrinsic to nature. They're doing battle with nature, and the fuel is supplied from somewhere other than the vehicle. So that when the fuel reserves are all used up, they're replenished at dispensing stations of one kind or another, which are also extrinsic to the units themselves. And in fact, our transportation modules, the whole grid system in the United States, for example, is designed to operate with a whole series of stratified supply-side components that make it possible to produce and deliver and dispense fuel for automobiles. So that concept says that you take the fuel from one place, put it in the car in another place, and you drive the car in a natural setting, but in a condition that is designed to be at war with the natural order of things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the self-recharging vehicle concept is just exactly the opposite of that. Our notion about this, based on the work of physicists like Richard Feynman and others, is based on the notion that the vehicle itself is part of a vast, infinite, inexhaustible energy envelope. And this intrinsic view suggests that if the ambient forms of energy that surround or encompass or embody the automobile can be captured and converted with sufficiently high efficiencies to useful power, then there's more than enough energy in the envelope to drive the vehicle as far and as fast as you need without any extrinsic support of any kind. That's a whole new way of looking at automobiles. And if we can accomplish that, it means that each automobile can perform as a self-contained unit without relying on any outside or extrinsic sources of energy.
So you're working with nature rather than against it.
That's right. And so what we've done then is said, all right, we've identified a dozen different kinds of energy that can be converted to a useful electric power and stored for future or current use at a degree of efficiency that is above or below what we think we need in order to make this thing work the way we want it to. So our design challenge has been, first of all, to identify the ambient energy sources and then discover what is available off the shelf, what the current technologies will allow us to do in order to convert those energy resources at one rate of efficiency or another into useful power.
In these 12 systems that are listed, basically all of those are already established, developed, to some degree perfected technologies. Is that correct?
It's true except for a couple of these. And you know, I don't know how much time you want to spend going into any kind of detail on them, but the general brushstroke is that, for example, everybody's familiar with photovoltaic solar cells. They convert sunlight into electric power.
Mm-hmm.
The current state of the art right now drives photovoltaic panels at something on the order of 8 to 10% efficiency. And that assumes that, you know, the skies are clear and the sun is bright and that there aren't any other things getting in the way. A 10% conversion ratio means that you simply don't have enough surface area in the transportation platform under normal circumstances to provide enough electricity to drive the motors that carry the platform and its passengers and baggage at any appreciable speed for any appreciable distance.
Right.
So it's just not efficient enough. But if someone were to invent a way to convert sunlight into electrical power at some exponentially higher rate, if you could convert it at 25%, for example, then that fundamentally alters the equation. There's always...
In a laboratory right now, they're pushing 40, even 50% efficiencies. And in application, I think they're as high as 25 right now.
The university development project at the University of South Africa last year announced the licensing of a new non-silica-based photovoltaic system, which they've licensed to a German company now, apparently. And their claim is that it operates at a minimum of 26% efficiency. The folks who invented the Lumaloid photovoltaic films in concert with the Argonne National Laboratories in Chicago provided mathematical models which showed that the theoretical limit in their material, which is a proprietary material, had potential efficiencies approaching 90%. So it's not a question of whether sunlight can be converted to energy that can be used. It's really a question of how long do we have to wait before we convert enough solar power at a high enough rate of efficiency to really make it effective in the application. But that's just one of a dozen different kinds of energy that are available. Mm-hmm. One of the most ubiquitous forms of energy is the heat that's in the roadbed and the heat that is in the air, ambient heat in the air itself. Well, those technologies, those energy conversion technologies, are pretty primitive right now. There's a 60-year track record of an integration that we refer to as a thermoelectric generator. Thermoelectric generator chips are about 3 inches square. They're about a quarter of an inch thick, and they convert heat to electrical power on the basis of the Seebeck effect at the rate, nominal rate, of between 4.5% and 5%. So theoretically, I mean, you can buy devices now over the internet. You sit them on top of your wood-burning stove, and it generates electric power that's rectified in a way. You can tap it into a light fixture or a unit to recharge your computer, or you can drive a radio with it. You can do all kinds of things with it. But it has to be real hot, and it's a pretty big, cumbersome device, so it's not very efficient. But if someone were able to create a material or a process that could capitalize on the Seebeck effect in a more efficient way, if you, for example, could convert road heat and ambient heat represented by temperature in the air surrounding a vehicle at 50% efficiency, then all bets are off. Because at a 50% efficiency, you can convert enough heat to enough electricity to drive virtually anything you can imagine, certainly between temperatures of 1 degree and 140 degrees centigrade. And that's a breakthrough that we're working on at the NOVA Institute. And we're not the only ones. You know, there are other people here in Salt Lake City that are working on this technology who are claiming that they have the ability to produce materials that can convert heat into electrical power.
Yeah, Eneco up in the University of Utah area, yeah, they're looking at 40% of the efficiency of the Carnot cycle.
So, you know, it's not that it can't be done. Someday somebody's going to produce the technology that will let us harness that feature. But there's energy also intrinsic to the very nature of the machine. Once you get it rolling, the mass represents energy. And that kinetic energy can be recaptured while the vehicle is coasting, while it's going downhill, while you're applying the brakes. All of those forms of energy conversion have now matured to a fairly efficient rate.
They do that in existing hybrid vehicles.
They do, for sure. It's been done for a long time. So, you know, we've got off-the-shelf components that make those kinds of energy conversion available at fairly high rates of efficiency. There's another class of materials called Peltier devices. The Peltier chip is the unit that everybody has on their barbecue. You turn the gas on, push the button, and it snaps, and that pressure exerted on the material creates enough voltage at a high enough current to send a spark across a gap. And that gap then lights the spark, lights the fumes of the gas that are coming out of your propane tank. There are all kinds of applications for Peltier materials, and they are operating at increasingly high rates of efficiency. But the application of the newest iteration of Peltier materials means that wherever you have road vibration or surface vibration in the material, wherever you have flexion in the suspension components, wherever you have pieces of the drivetrain that are rotating in a circle, wherever you have things in motion, you can use Peltier materials to capture some of that energy and convert it into electrical power. And that technology is getting better and better.
Now, how does that compare to the piezoelectric?
Piezo is what I'm talking about. Peltier is a different material. I get my words mixed up.
Okay.
Piezo operates by flexion. Peltier materials are materials that either absorb or emit heat when direct current voltage is applied to them. So in our design, we've got a couple of design challenges. A common kind of challenge that has to be addressed in the development of a useful vehicular platform is, how do you replace all of the compressor pump fluorocarbon functions that are used to heat and cool automobiles? How do you heat and cool components or passenger compartments if you don't have pumps and fluids and compressors? They're not efficient, they require a lot of horsepower, and they're dangerous in an ecological sense. Well, we're using Peltier chips for a couple of things in our designs. We couple the Peltier chips with the thermal electric generator chips. We use solar cells, photovoltaic cells, to provide the power to the Peltiers so that we can control the temperature differential between the top surface and the bottom surface of the thermal electric chips. The thermal electrics operate at an optimal rate in a certain temperature differential range. So at a differential of about 30 degrees Fahrenheit, if we can maintain that differential between the top surface and the bottom surface, convert sunlight, use that sunlight to power the Peltiers, use a computer and thermocouples to make sure that we maintain those temperature differentials in an optimum range, then we get the best of all possible worlds. So the combination of piezoelectric and Peltier chips and thermal electric generator chips and photovoltaic cells, all those things together get us to within about 60% of the 60-amp continuous draw that's needed to power a 1,500-pound vehicle at highway speeds. There are some other things that we can do. The fact that this thing operates, whether it's sitting still, the system produces power that's being converted whether the vehicle is moving or not. And if you use the latest iteration of deep discharge lithium ion batteries, such as the ones made by Valence down in Houston, Texas, for example, these things are guaranteed to provide 300,000 full charge and recharge cycles before failure. Well, that's about 10 years worth of driving every day. And so, you know, the combination of a way to store the electricity that you generate so that it's there when you need it, and a way to make sure that you can draw it down efficiently and effectively without having a limiting effect based on the life cycle of the batteries is an important feature.
So while a car is sitting there not being driven, it's still generating electricity that's charging the batteries that can make up for the 60%, in other words, it can make up the 40% to give the 100% added to the 60%.
And that's particularly important when the sun is not shining, or at night, or when it's cold. So, you know, you've got requirements that take you into places where there's not a lot of sunlight and there's not a lot of heat, So there are other things that you need to be able to do to make this thing work efficiently, and having good batteries and good energy accumulator devices is an important ingredient.
Would you plan on integrating into this vehicle some kind of a plug-in capacity so that you can top things off if necessary? Let's say you are in a cold and dark climate.
Of course. I mean, we have to get to the point by degrees where the basic concept is, you know, we're still in the Model A Ford period of this technology. We can do it. We can make it work. We can't make it work perfectly. We can't make it work at sufficiently high aggregate efficiencies to make it completely self-sustaining. We want to get it into the market. We want people to be able to use it. So in order to do that, we're going to have to make up for what it can't do in the early stages by allowing people to plug it in and top it off.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we're hoping that one or the other of the modules that we're working with will be replaced by a real breakthrough in one of the technologies or other that we're using. But until that happens, we can make up a lot of difference by being smart, by making the vehicles aerodynamic, by using very low resistance tires, by using very high efficiency electric motors, by designing the systems so that they integrate supercapacitor devices such as the ones that are made by the Russians for their electric Hyster technologies, which allow you to take real hard, high rate discharge functions for accelerating or going up hills or whatever on a short term, starting from a dead scratch, without having to draw amperage from the battery. If we can keep these things operating on voltage, they'll run for a long, long time and be very, very, very efficient. But most of the motors that are available out there and the controllers that go with them, including some of the latest stuff that's coming out of Holland, rely on dropping to a low-end discharge based on amperage rather than just the voltage, and that really quickly dissipates the charge in the battery. So we're using supercapacitors to set that off, and we've been working with a number of domestic and foreign manufacturers to see if the new technologies where the motor is actually embodied in the wheel can be applied to this kind of a design efficiently. Wheel motors, there are now six big companies that are manufacturing wheel motors. The advantage of those, of course, is that you do away with everything else in the powertrain. You have no drive shaft, no transmissions, no clutches, none of the other mass that is part of an internal combustion engine.
Do those also serve as generators?
They do.
When you're doing
they have, for example, Honda's new in-wheel motor that they're designing for their electric hybrid operates at a nominal efficiency in excess of 96%. And that's just spectacular because it means that, you know, day in and day out, uphill and downhill, you're only losing 4% to overcoming inertia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's spectacular. And they're not the only ones who are doing that, but their units also have regenerative braking capacity, and they have you know, some really interesting cooling strategies for keeping the components from overheating and all of that sort of stuff. So the technology is getting much, much better. One of the advantages of using an integrated system like this, where you draw from a variety of different sources of energy, is that when you add up the mass of all of our components, if we just buy things off the shelf and presume that they're going to operate at their nominal rated specification, you still reduce the mass of the automobile by somewhere between 40 and 60% by taking out the engine, by taking out the transmission, and the drive line and the differential and the gas tank and the radiator and all the hoses and all of those things. There's a lot of mass there. When you take all that stuff out, even when you put batteries and electric motors back in, you still have a significant reduction in mass. And that's important because you don't want to be moving any more mass than you have to do what you want to do. So those kinds of efficiencies are also part of the design engineering process.
In point number 10, you talk about, actually 11, you talk about this polycarbonate body component for a lightweight body.
Right.
What about safety considerations?
Well, there are some safety considerations. And what we're going to try to do in our phase one is to build the vehicle that proves the concept. We're not experts in automobile design. We're not in the manufacturing business. We don't pretend to have any expertise other than finding clever and inventive ways to integrate these energy conversion technologies together. And you certainly don't want to take a bunch of plastic cars out on the highway and do battle with 18-wheelers. You know, that's not a safe and smart thing to do. But in the early stages, what we're going to do is use advanced kit car designs that use lightweight polycarbonate bodies simply because they've already been certified by the National Transportation Safety Board. We can insure them, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel on that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When we do get to the point where, you know, the proof of concept is really working, then ultimately we'll license this integration to manufacturers in the mainstream who are manufacturing automobiles and other kinds of vehicles all the time. And there will have to be adjustments. Now, there are some technologies available that have not been used to manufacture cars yet, which are used to manufacture components for aerospace systems that are very strong and very lightweight and extremely efficient. And we're hoping that at some point down the road, we'll be able to bring some of those technologies to bear on the way automobiles are manufactured. But, you know, we're only going to try to attack one massive problem at a time here.
Have you looked at the Hildenbrand or the Joseph Flynn technology where you can get 2 to 4 times more out from your motor due to, an amplification effect of the magnetic fields?
Well, we've examined some over-unity motor technologies. We haven't found one that really does what it's claimed to do yet. I guess if you ever got to the point where your motor was really producing more energy than it was consuming, then you don't need to worry about it. You know, but
these aren't so much a situation of over-unity. The Flynn one is more a matter of getting more torque for the amount of input. Boeing is licensing it. They're working with Boeing, and they're working with, I think, the U.S. Army on the Flynn technology. So it's definitely bona fide, something you might want to look into.
Well, we're certainly open to suggestion, and we certainly don't pretend to know everything about it. It's a big, wide, wonderful world, and we're learning new things all the time. We have had some correspondence with the folks in Japan who manufacture the Minato motor. And I don't know if you're familiar with that technology, but it's pretty spectacular. And, you know, the rates of efficiency that they're operating those little 12-volt electric motors is just off the charts.
Were you able to actually witness that?
We actually have had one of our people go to Minato, and we've exchanged documents with them. We've had direct contact with them. We're not convinced that it's as scalable as they want us to believe. And the proof of the pudding will come when our joint development arrangements actually get focused on building a scalable prototype. There's some other folks here in the Salt Lake Valley who are building some very interesting motor technologies. Razor Technologies down in Utah County are building some very high-speed switching motors with extraordinary torque characteristics using ultra-pure ferrite materials. Really exciting stuff. So we're always open to suggestion, and one of the things that we'll be trying to do as we go through the development process is to design the initial platform so that we can easily switch out motor components. We'll be doing a lot of testing in the laboratory, hooking them up to pony brakes and other kinds of testing devices to see just exactly what kind of characteristics they do produce.
Make it a plug-and-play system similar to the intercompatibilities of computer
that's our
motherboards.
That's one of our goals, because mm-hmm. the potential certainly exists for existing technologies and materials to be quickly supplanted by breakthrough technologies in the same area.
Mm-hmm.
We have some of those operating in prototype in our own laboratory, and we know there are people all over the planet who are doing extraordinary work with materials. So what we're really trying to do here, using bubblegum and baling wire and the best things that we can find today, is provide a point of focus to prove that the paradigm shift from an extrinsic model to an intrinsic model can actually be made operative and can be both efficient and cost-effective. And we think we can do that. We've done our modeling with a variety of different folks. We've used nonlinear computer modeling to model each of the technologies independently and then to integrate them sequentially together, so that we now have a very robust computer model that helps us see what we can expect to have happen from midnight to midnight in a typical day with these components configured in the way that they're described in our write-ups. Mm-hmm. And we're convinced we can do this. We think we can make it work.
What kind of pricing are you anticipating on this technology? I know you're fairly early in the development of it, but once this thing goes commercial and you can do some economy of scale, what kind of a sticker price are you talking about for somebody to pick up one of these cars?
Well, it's an interesting question. The prototypes, like all concept cars, prototype automobiles with these exotic systems in them, are amortizations of a lot of sunk time and cost. So our guess is that it's going to cost us probably $1 million a piece to build the first three models of this thing. Having said that, once you get the pieces operating, if we just assume that we're using off-the-shelf stuff and paying the quantity discount rates for manufacturing in quantity at some level, our best guess is that we can roll these babies out the door fully configured with all of the safety features and all the other things that are part of ordinary automobile technology for something between $40,000 and $50,000 a unit early in the cycle. And as you build more units and as your technology gets better, that cost can come down.
Would that be for a sports car or for a...
I don't think it matters. You know, the cost to manufacture units of the kind we're talking about is not nearly so dependent on things like bigger engines and bigger wheels and bigger tires and bigger body shells. The model that drives Detroit doesn't apply in a linear way to this kind of manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a lot of things about the way you build and design these cars that are fundamentally the same regardless of the shape. So, you know, there are some practical limitations. I mean, electric motors that will take a 1,500-pound vehicle package down the road at 75 miles an hour are in the supply side is not well developed for those. There aren't many options. and the options that are available are not really optimized for that kind of performance yet. Which is not to say you can't buy them. You can, but they're very expensive, and you know they're made under the really almost handmade in many cases. So the turn times between the time you order them and the time you take delivery of them from a supplier is not optimal right now. The whole industry, the whole business of putting this stuff together will require some time to settle out and optimize, and that's not something we're going to worry about. We just want to prove the concept and make the darn thing work. And in the laboratory, we're getting the results that we've anticipated, and in some cases, we're doing better than we'd hoped. So there are a couple of other pieces of this puzzle that are important. At some
we've
point
not
in
talked
time,
about the Freon rotary
yeah,
engine.
Yeah, that's where we're heading.
Yet.
At some point in time, in order to breach this self-sustaining level of performance, this barrier, you have to have a way on board to provide enough power on demand to perform current functions. You got to be able to have enough juice to drive as fast and as far as you need to, but at some point you also have to have the ability, regardless of time of day or weather or season, to recharge whatever kind of load modulator, whether it's an energy accumulator or a supercapacitor or battery banks or whatever. You've got to have a way to recharge those without having to go put fuel in it or plug it into the grid somewhere. And the ability to do that really requires some pretty inventive thinking. We've entered into a relationship with an extraordinary inventor, lives in Carson City, who has developed a rotary engine, operates with extremely high efficiencies, which is driven by a specific variety of fluorocarbon. And this brand of Freon, which used to be used in refrigerators of all kinds, has an attribute that's very useful to us, but which is really bad news for refrigerators and seals, and that is that it develops very high pressures when it's compressed. The compression cycle on this stuff generates enormous head pressure. Well, for us, that's wonderful, because it means that the fact that this stuff operates as a liquid at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, but is totally gasified within 4 degrees Fahrenheit, means that this narrow gasification coefficient can be harnessed with these very high head pressures in a closed system, so that if you apply temperature at an intake and elevate the temperature of the liquid by 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit, that the energy that is produced by that input will create a sufficiently high head pressure to drive a rotary engine assembly 310 to 320 degrees before it recompresses and becomes liquid again. And what you do then is you exhaust that stuff with a little laminar pump, you put it back into the reservoir, and you reuse it so that there is no exhaust. Nothing is consumed except the energy that's being used to heat the Freon to drive the engine. And all of the sources of energy that you see there at one level or another, day or night, cold or hot, will produce heat that will drive this system so that it becomes an onboard battery recharger that runs all the time. It's a very efficient little device. We have a second evolution prototype sitting on the test bench in the laboratory, and this little baby just sits there all day long and it operates at 1800 RPM constant. You're not drawing power directly off the unit. All the power comes off and goes through a rectifier into a battery bank, so you take your power off the batteries. the day and night. It just sits there and runs. And as it runs, it's running an alternator, and the alternator is driving power into the batteries. It's a great little technology, and it's working. We're at the point now where we believe we've got it refined sufficiently that we can contract to have it manufactured as a specific component that goes into the system. And from a practical point of view, what that means is that you've got an onboard battery recharger that's running all the time. Sounds like a Singer sewing machine. It just sits there and goes tick, 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 makes no noise at all.
Just on a tangent there, with that technology, I would think that the number of applications are much more than just vehicular.
Well, sure they are.
What kind of arrangement do you have with him? Are you just licensed for the vehicle application, or are you going to be helping him get that into other applications as well?
We have a joint development agreement that supports the development of the technology, and Nova acts then as the agent for licensing for all of the fields of use. So, you know, by taking the risk and going to the time and expense of developing the underlying technology, we then are able to step into the market and do applications engineering and licensing and manufacturing. And the inventor is happy to have us do that because he's getting a little long in the tooth like the rest of us, and happy to have the technology working and happy to have it generating revenue and meeting its objectives without having to go out and do all the marketing and the licensing and the legal and all the other stuff that goes with it.
Mm-hmm.
So this physical device, eventually, Sterling, will be replaced by a solid-state device. There are a number of technologies that have been talked about over the years as candidates for this. They all have some very specific practical problems. One of those kinds of devices that's been discussed for a long, long time is a device that capitalizes on an effect that was identified in 1948 by a Hungarian scientist by the name of Cedric Casimir. Casimir recognized that when you approach closure between metal components at very, very fine tolerances, that there comes a point at which enormous energy is liberated. The Casimir effect has long been recognized in science. A lot of PhDs have been awarded based on dissertations written about it. A lot of money been spent by lots of folks trying to figure out how to harness it. And the one issue that no one has been able to resolve is the issue that reduces the resistance to electrical conductance in the materials so that the electrons that are liberated by the Casimir effect can actually be captured and used at some rate of efficiency to perform work. We have a variation on that device operating in our laboratory now, and it isn't doing what we want it to quite yet, but we're hopeful that by applying some of our own proprietary technologies, including a positively charged, electrically conductive film, we'll be able to reduce the resistance, if not to supercapacitive levels, certainly to exceedingly low resistance levels, so that when we oscillate the Casimir plate, we'll be able to generate electrons, and we'll be able to capture them, and we'll be able to harness them. We're pretty excited, actually, about where that's going and looking forward to the time when a solid-state device that has no moving parts can be used to capitalize on the energy that's available in the physical vacuum and do it in a way that's cost-effective and safe and efficient and replace the oscillating, rotating, angular momentum-type devices that are represented by this Polary engine system. So we're hoping that either in our laboratory or in somebody else's laboratory where a bunch of really smart guys are doing really good work, somebody will figure out how to solve that part of the problem. And when they do, then the age of the electric automobile will be upon us with a vengeance, because it will mean that all the basic work to build all of the basic pieces that make it a viable concept will already be in place. So we're hoping that we can catch that wave early, participate in defining some of those standards, do the groundbreaking, heavy hauling, bushwhacking kind of work out on the leading edge of it, so that we can get this concept into the marketplace and make it available to people.
You're talking about these different modalities. You've got the piezoelectric, you've got the Peltier, you've got this Freon system. You've got a number of different technologies, all of which are, to a more or less extent, on the cutting edge. They're still maybe even on the bleeding edge, where there's, you know, just cutting teeth on it.
Exactly right.
And I'm just wondering, from a business point of view, do you ever feel like you've bitten off more than you can chew?
Well, it's a daunting kind of process. We kind of take some comfort in, you know, what happened with the airplane. I mean, we're really doing what, with an electric car, what the Wright brothers did with the airplane. They were careful. They were thorough. They certainly didn't solve all the problems, but the ones they did solve, they did well enough that people still rely on their work today. I mean, their propeller designs were fabulous, and people still use them. The basic principle of aerodynamic heavier-than-air flight took 35 years to find a fully integrated embodiment in the DC-3. Because all the underlying enabling technologies took 30 years to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what's going to happen here. What we're doing is building the 21st century automobile equivalent of the Wright Flyer. And we're trying to do as good a work on our project as they did on theirs, knowing that at some point in time in the future, either the technologies we're using or other technologies that we don't know about yet will come along, become sufficiently matured so that at some point in time a fully integrated platform will become possible at a cost, at a rate of efficiency that makes it then commercially viable to get into the marketplace. We don't pretend to have all those problems solved at the beginning because it doesn't make any sense. And we know we've got some challenges. So what we're doing is relying on off-the-shelf components as much as we can, doing as good a job as we can of integrating them into an efficient operating system, and working on the leading-edge technologies that are proprietary to us and to our development partners, working very hard to try to create the breakthroughs that we need in order to drive this thing over the edge and become fully self-sustaining. And we're convinced, based on what we're seeing, that that's not far off. We're either going to do it or somebody else is going to do it, but it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. One of the corollary questions to the one I just asked is, as I look at your mission statement at Nova Technologies, or Nova Institute of Technologies, you have a fairly broad umbrella of interest, and you have a scope of reviewing new technologies. You've developed this algorithm, so to speak, where you can take a new technology, see, and let the inventor know what's involved from paper to prototype to marketplace. They see the full process. You do some screening. In other words, you haven't stopped with this project. It sounds to me like you have a continual inflow of new ideas. I'm just wondering, how do you balance the notion of focusing and doing a really good job on the thing you focus on, as opposed to being watered down by so many, too many irons in the fire?
Well, nobody can do everything at once. We certainly know that. We've been to school on, you know, what happened at Motorola and the 3M experience and the Xerox campus and the Skunk Works at Lockheed and, you know, attempts that have been made in the past to embrace an increasingly broad range of technologies and applications, and you know, we're certainly aware of the challenges that are involved with that. What we've tried to do here, so we don't make the same mistakes that other people have made and paint ourselves into the proverbial corner, is to organize our projects so that they really are fundamentally self-contained. The projects are self-contained by design in terms of the resources and the people and the capital. What Nova Institute does is facilitate the encapsulation of an undertaking and then provide an umbrella of services for our own people and for our joint development partners, so that the development partners don't have to worry about running businesses. They don't have to worry about payroll and taxes and procurement and legal and accounting and public relations and distribution and sales and all of that stuff. Nova provides, as an organization, its primary function in the organization chart is to provide that umbrella and the guidance and the mentoring skills to facilitate the development of the technologies. But each project is designed as an encapsulated undertaking. And when funding is made available, then we make a decision based on this pipeline that we've developed. We go through a rigorous process of making sure that if we find a technology or if we find an integration that we think is noteworthy, that may merit further consideration, we have an entry point that is not negotiable either for Nova or for the people that we work with. It's standardized. We've spent a lot of time and money building it. It's the product of about 6 years worth of real hard work and a lot of expense. And it serves us very well because it helps us not to make the early stage mistakes that get so many projects in trouble. It costs us a little time and money. We have a team of people whose only job is to drive pieces through this process. It has a series of stages and gates that terminate in go, no-go, or review decisions. Documentation is made available. The inquiry and due diligence process is intrinsic to the whole program. So that by the time we decide we're going to do a development, there's been an awful lot of time and money spent to make sure, one, that it's merit-worthy, two, that it's commercially viable, three, that it justifies the kind of time and energy and expense that's going to be required, and four, that we have some reason to believe that when we take it to market, there's going to be a demand for it. Some of the projects have a longer term than others. This electric vehicle project's got a long term. It's going to take a long time for this to catch on.
How many projects have you been able to take to marketplace using this pipeline?
We have two important technologies that we're in the process of negotiating licensing agreements for now. One of them is an integration that we were notified just yesterday by the patent office that our new claims have all been allowed. It's referred to in the documentation as the electronically shaded glass. The objective of that exercise was to create a transparent viewing panel that is transparent and transmissive to light in its native state at rest, but which can be manipulated in a couple of different ways by applying voltage or varying waveforms or varying frequencies so that the panel gets progressively darker. That is, it shades it by limiting the transmissivity of the glass, or it polarizes the light that is coming in from one direction or the other, or it actually changes the color of the panel. We have a prototype of this product. We're in the second generation of it. We're now in the process of working through the licensing arrangements with Pilkington Glass through their former director of research and development, who just recently retired. He's hand-carrying this technology to Pilkington for us. It's a wonderful technology because it It uses some of our own proprietary transparent electrically conducted thin film technologies, electrical luminescent technologies, laser glass technologies, and so on. But it means that with these panels, you can retrofit existing buildings and homes so that you can cut the amount of heat, infrared heat buildup in a room that results from sunlight by anywhere from 40 to 60%. It also can be engineered to either permit or absorb the ultraviolet, depending on what you want it to do. So, I mean, it has all kinds of important and interesting uses. There's a huge market out there for it, and we own this technology lock, stock, and barrel. This one, we think, in the next few years, taken into the market under appropriate licensing agreements, can really be used in 12 specific markets. And, you know, I'm not at liberty to talk about the kind of dollars that we're anticipating, but I can tell you that they're significant because the world markets are really looking for this stuff. So that technology is now on the cusp of going to market. It is commercially viable, and we're negotiating our licensing. And we have a couple of others like that are in that stage.
We are almost out of time. We started late, so we'll end a little bit late. Apparently, the BBS radio has taken a week off, and we didn't know about that. And Don Newsom was generous to let us go ahead and come on. I appreciate that. Two questions before we end. Number one, people who want to put money into your system, where do you direct them? Number two, your website address.
Let me answer the second one first. Anybody can find a description of who we are and what we're doing, and a description of the kinds of scalar physical models that we're using by going to www.novainstituteoftechnology.com. There is a contact link there, so if anybody wants to have a discussion with us about who we are and what we're doing and the technologies that we're involved in developing, they can contact us in that way. We're not accepting any money from outside sources at this point. We have arranged for capitalization for the projects that are shown there, and so we're not inviting anyone to participate financially with us at this point in time.
I guess one final question. How long before we see this car, this self-recharging electric vehicle driving down the road?
Well, if I have my way, we'll have the first of these little babies on the road in front of God and the angels and the TV cameras sometime in the middle of the summer of 2007. We're really looking forward to getting this thing on the street. We've got it sourced. We've got the pieces put together. We know what to do and how to do it, and we're just anxious for New Year's to get past us so we can get going.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dave, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I appreciate you joining us. For listeners tuned in, you can catch our archives and see what our upcoming shows are at freeenergynow.net. You can catch us every day at freeenergynews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. You're certainly welcome.